Alan Hayek, Chairman of the Department of Astronomy, Northwestern University, Director, Center for UFO Studies, Dr. James A. Harder, Professor of Civil Engineering, University of California, Director of Research, APRO. 16, Chapter 1, A Very Strange Phenomenon. Charles Hickson, age 45, an 18-year-old Calvin Parker, were fishing when an oblong, blue-gray craft 35 to 40 feet long descended and hovered near them. The craft made a zipping noise. A door appeared in the craft and three humanoids or robots came out and approached the two men. Like their craft, these entities did not touch the ground but moved just above it, proceeding without moving their legs. The entities were short and had elephant hide skin, slits for eyes, and pincer-like hands. When Parker saw the entities approach, he passed out. Hickswain was paralyzed, but it was able to continue observing what happened. Two of the entities picked up Hickson by his arms and carried him inside the ship. When he was picked up, Hickson lost all feeling, including that of weight. He was taken to a bare, brightly lit room. He could not see where the light came from. The entities placed him in a reclining position, still floating in air, and an eye-like instrument scanned back and forth across his body with thoroughness, as if it were examining or photographing him. This episode lasted somewhere between 15 and 40 minutes. Hickson is not at all sure about the time. After the examination was over, the entities left Hickson alone for a while, and then floated him back to where they had picked him up on the river bank. About an hour later, the two shaken fishermen went to the sheriff's office to report their story. They were interrogated exhaustively and afterwards were left alone, in a bugged room. The recording of their conversation at that time reveals that both men were quite frightened by their experience, the emotional trauma having been so great to Parker that, after Hickson left the room, he began to pray. Ultimately, he suffered a nervous breakdown as a result of this experience. Hickson, though plagued with nightmares and continuing feelings of terror about the experience, came through it better and was able to work with investigators who wished to ascertain the truth about his experience. A 2.5-hour lie detector test, given by a highly skeptical polygraph operator, revealed that Hickson was telling the truth. When Dr. Harder used the technique of time regression hypnosis on Hickson, he too felt that Hickson was telling the truth about the experience, for he said a strong feeling of terror is practically impossible to fake under hypnosis. Case number 68, the 25th of October 1973. Place, Greensburg, Pennsylvania. Investigator, Berthold Eric Schwartz, M.D., Consultant, Brainwave, 17. Chapter 1, A Very Strange Phenomenon. Laboratory, Essex Company Hospital Center, Cedar Grove, New Jersey, Consultant to Flying Saucer Review. This case is perhaps the most interesting and many-faceted of the 188 Pennsylvania creature sightings included in case number 4. It began at 9 o'clock at night, when a young farmer, called Stephen Pulaski, in the report given in Flying Saucer Review, and at least 15 other witnesses, saw a bright red ball hovering over a field near them. Stephen grabbed a 30.06 rifle, and he and two 10-year-old neighbor boys went to investigate it. Stephen's auto headlights dimmed as he neared the object, and as the object descended towards the field, Stephen's German Shepherd, back at the house, became very disturbed. The object was now bright white, and appeared to be about 100 feet in diameter. It was buzzing much like a lawnmower would. They stood watching the object on the ground, and then the neighbor boys saw something walking along by the fence. Stephen thought it looked like two bears, and he fired a tracer bullet over the bears' heads. The creatures were very tall, one 7 feet, the other over 8 feet tall. These measurements were easier than usual to get because the entities were silhouetted against the fence and so could be accurately judged. They were hairy and long-armed, with greenish-yellow eyes. They made a noise like a baby whining. A smell like burning rubber was present. Stephen, realizing that these creatures were not bears and that they were coming nearer to him, fired over the entities' heads once more and, when they kept on coming, fired directly at the larger creature. When the creature was hit, The glowing 150 feet diameter object disappeared from the field, instantaneously, and the motor noise stopped. The two creatures turned around and walked back towards the woods. In the field where the object had been was a glowing area about 150 feet in diameter, which was gone by the next morning. While it was still there, a state trooper who came to investigate the story went up to within 200 yards of it, then stopped, went back to call in the UFO researcher Stan Gordon. The trooper felt that Stephen was so disturbed that it was better that he be watched, and Stephen wouldn't go near the glowing area. It was 2 a.m. when Stan Gordon's study group team and Stephen and his father went back to the landing site. The animals were acting scared, and Stephen's dog was tracking something which no one could see at the edge of the woods. Suddenly Stephen began rubbing his head and face and looking as though he were about to faint. Several people approached him, but he, 18, chapter 1, a very strange phenomenon threw them off, growling like an animal and flailing his arms. His own dog ran towards him and Stephen attacked the dog. Two of the investigators also experienced some feelings of lightheartedness and difficulty in breathing at this point. Stephen continued running around, growling and swinging his arms, and then collapsed in a manured area, face down. He lay there for a time, then began to come to himself, and said, "Get away from me. It's here. Get back." Sulfur-like odor was noticed. Stephen and the group got away from the area, but Stephen kept mumbling that he would protect the group. He said he saw a man in a black hat and cloak, who told Stephen, "If man doesn't straighten up, the end is near." The man also told Stephen, "There is a man here now, who can save the world." Needless to say, the investigators present felt quite concerned about Stephen's health, and it was here that Dr. Schwartz was called in. Dr. Schwartz's subsequent psychiatric study of Stephen yielded results that he feels point clearly to the incident having occurred just as reported, for indeed it would be terrifying for a man such as Stephen, used to a very practical and realistic type of life, to shoot and hit an 8-foot antagonist which then was not harmed in any way. The numerous other witnesses to the various phases of the incident also bear out its having happened. Who was the man in black? And what do the predictions about mankind really mean? That is a matter for interpretation. But that Stephen had the experience has been thoroughly documented. Case number 7, date, the 28th of October 1973, place, Bahia Blanca, Argentina. Investigator, Liria Di Giorgi, APRO investigator. Very early in the morning, truck driver Diane Izio Lanca had a flat tire and pulled off the road in an isolated area. As he set up the jack to change the tire, he saw lights in the distance, but thought little of them until, as they approached, they suddenly changed to a brilliant blue. When Lanca tried to get up and look for the source of this odd light, he found he was apparently paralyzed and could not move. He was able to see, however, as a dome-topped disc came to rest, hovering just above the ground near the truck. On the ground by the craft were three humanoid entities, two men and a woman. They had long blonde hair and elongated eyes, and wore silver, nappy suits with high boots, no helmets, no weapons. After the entities had talked among themselves, one of them lifted Lanca by the neck of his sweater. Lanca was desperately frightened, but the man put, 19, chapter 1, a very strange phenomenon, a small black box against his left index finger, and instantly he began to relax. In a few seconds, he was unconscious. The next morning he awakened on the roadside and made his way back to civilization. He told his story and investigation was undertaken, but although competent doctors used hypnotherapy and truth serum with Lanca, he could not remember a portion of his experiences aboard the craft. He was able to tell the investigators that these entities had been contacting people on Earth since 1950. And that their purpose was to discover whether Earthmen could live in their world. He described the interior of the ship, and said that he went into the ship not by stairs or a ramp, but on a ray of light. But he reported that the beings did not want him to remember some of his experience aboard their craft, and he would not be able to. The message that came from him after intense probing for information was this: I have a message from the beings in the craft, but I can't tell you what it is. No matter what you or any other Earth scientists do, there will remain the memory lapse while I was on the ship. The medical personnel working on this case agree with this statement, and feel that to probe any deeper in Lanka's subconscious for this experience might damage his health. But they feel that his experience was, though unbelievable, quite real. Case number 8, date, the 1st of July 1974, place, Warneton, Belgium. Investigators, MSSRS, Basin Senior and Junior, Mr. Bighorn, Mr. Boyden, MUFON. Investigators. An anonymous witness driving along the French-Belgian border experienced engine failure. His lights and radio also went out. At this point he saw a landed UFO about 160 yards away across a field. The 30-foot-wide craft was shaped like a World War I British helmet and was glowing a patchy orange, with white light coming from beneath it. Two entities were walking slowly and stiffly toward the witness. Both were about 4 feet tall, with grayish skin, round eyes, a rudimentary nose, and a slit-like, lipless mouth. They wore helmets and metallic gray coverall-type uniforms. One had an object in his hand shaped like a short, thick ruler with a pointed tip. He was aiming it at the car. When the beings came to within 12 feet of the car, one of them opened and closed his mouth, and the witness felt a slight shock at the back of his head and heard a low-pitched, modulated sound. Then the entities turned about. 20, Chapter 1, a very strange phenomenon, and reboarded their craft, which began pulsating an electric blue glow. Its tripod legs withdrew, it rose and hovered momentarily, then rapidly ascended at a 60-degree angle. As the witness prepared to leave the site, another car drove up. Its driver had also seen the UFO and the beings. Case number 9, date, Easter Sunday, 1974, place, Bardstown, Key. Investigators, Lawrence Allison and D.T. Elkins. A boy in his late teens was driving alone at night and wondering why he was doing so. He had almost compulsively gone out to take the ride and had no purpose in mind, when a man appeared beside him in the car. He asked the startled boy if he remembered him, which he did not. Then suddenly he was inside a large room, he and his car. The passenger welcomed him aboard, and proceeded to show the boy around the craft. After the tour was completed, the guide, who looked like a normal Earthman and was casually dressed in a shirt and blue jeans, asked him to get back into his car. The boy did so and found himself suddenly back on the road. Investigations to find more details of this encounter are continuing. Case number 10, date, the 4th of October 1974, place, White House, Ohio. Investigators, Earl Neff and Larry Moaz, MUFON. Field investigators. Sam, an alias, had spent an evening with a friend who claimed to be a contactee of the UFOs. During this meeting, he had asked the contactee for proof of the UFO's reality. On the way home from work the next night, shortly after midnight, his car's engine and light died. As he got out of the car, he noticed another car stop behind him. A very prosperous-looking, gray-haired man, he got out of the car and came over to him. This normal-looking human then offered Sam proof, by dematerializing a rock with a small hand-held implement. Then he told Sam to save his marriage, and promised that he would be contacted again. Case number 11, date, the 26th of May 1974, place, Mitchell Caverns, California. Investigator, Ida Blipperson, MUFON. Field investigator. 21, Chapter 1, a very strange phenomenon. This witness had seen UFOs several times in the past. One evening he was awakened in his camper by a humming sound and pulsating lights. He tried to call his family, but was immobilized. He saw four pinwheels of odd-shaped colored lights, red, orange, yellow, and blue-green. He awoke the next morning with bloodshot eyes and an aching body. It was 2 hours later than his usual rising time. He had impressions of having been inside a UFO, but a memory lapse blocked out details. At a later date, under hypnosis, he recalled being inside the craft and described a row of gyroscopes along an inner wall. The pinwheels of colored lights energized these to form an artificial gravity field. He had seen eight men, normal looking, 7 of them dressed in maroon foil-like uniforms, the 8th clad in a soft, pale blue outfit. He saw a view screen which was showing a close-up view of Saturn, a control panel, and 3 recliner-type chairs. The entities examined his eyes with a magnifying glass. The witness says that he expects to receive further contacts from these entities. Case number 12, date the 9th of March 1974, place Duxbury, Mass. Investigator John J. Ambrone, MUFON field investigator. One day, early in the morning, this very reluctant woman witnessed a red pulsating UFO at treetop level, and 2 light beams which shone across the bog caused her car to die, while the radio gave out static. Not long after this incident, the woman got a telepathic message to drive her car down a certain road, which she did. Again the radio and engine quit, but this time 4 small humanoids appeared, moving rapidly towards her, each astride a small vehicle that looked like a rototiller but moving rapidly above rather than on the ground. One of the entities approached her car and telepathically asked her to open the door, but when she did not comply, all 4 doors flew open anyway. The entity examined her and touched her on the nape of the neck with a small implement which left 5 small puncture marks. She was told that they have thousands of ships which have been visiting Earth for many years. They have a mother ship nearby, she was told, and their home planet is called Omnius or Omnigus. They have examined many people, not all of them voluntarily. She was asked not to touch them because of possible contamination and was warned that she would have severe headaches for several weeks after this contact. These entities were 4 to 5 feet tall, had helmets on which concealed their faces but through which small, shiny eyes. 22, Chapter 1, a very strange phenomenon could be seen. They were dressed in uniforms, the belts of which featured an emblem with vertical wavy lines. This witness was terrified by this encounter and has refused to allow any investigation by any group. The details given here were supplied to MUFON in strict anonymity by her husband. This woman denies to any questioner that the event ever occurred. Case number 13, date the 25th of October 1974, place Medicine Bow National Park, Wyoming. Investigators Dr. Leo Sprinkle, professor of psychology, University of Wyoming, investigator for APRO and MUFON, Rick Kenyon and Robert Nantx, MUFON field investigators, and Frank Bck, National Star investigator. Carl Higdon was hunting elk in the northern area of the park. He fired at one, but saw his bullet leave the rifle in slow motion and drop to the snow about 50 feet away. Feeling a tingle, he turned and saw a humanoid entity over 6 feet tall standing nearby. The entity wore a black jumpsuit with a wide belt, upon which was a 6-pointed star and a yellow emblem. The entity had bristle-like, straight hair standing straight out from his head, small eyes, no eyebrows or chin, bow-legged, long-armed, and with rod-like manipulators instead of hands. He might have had hands but Higdon never saw them. The entity approached Higdon and asked if he was hungry, and flipped him a little bunch of pills, which Higdon swallowed. Perhaps the entity felt that Higdon would not be hunting unless he needed food. The entity pointed at Higdon, and suddenly Higdon found himself within a transparent, cubical craft in company with 2 UFO nauts and 5 elk. They told him they were on their way to their home planet some 163,000 light-years away, and shortly they were there. They had put a helmet with wires sticking out of it on Higdon's head. He saw a tall, Seattle Space Needle-type building and a type of sunlight which was very intense and made his eyes water. The entities told him that our sun does the same thing to their eyes. The next thing Higdon remembers is being back in the park, about 2½ hours having elapsed since the first sight of the entity. He was cold, disoriented, and nearly hysterical. His truck was not where he had left it. He found it about 3 miles away, stuck in a mud hole. From here he sent out, 23, Chapter 1, a very strange phenomenon, a distress call over his CB radio, and the sheriff picked him up at midnight. By now, Higdon was in a state of panic and near nervous exhaustion, shouting, "They took my elk!" They took him to the hospital and checked him over. Oddly, His blood tests showed a very rich supply of vitamins. Those food pellets must have been nutritive, and old TB scars on his lungs had disappeared. Later investigation found that Higden's wife and two others had seen a red-green-white flashing light moving back and forth across this area. When Dr. Sprinkle used time regression hypnosis on Higden, he found out more about his experience. Higden was able to recall that other Earth people had been present, and he said that the aliens had come to Earth to hunt and fish for food. Case number 14, date, the 13th of August 1975. Place, Alamos Gordo, New Mexico. Investigator, National Enquirer, APRO Staff Sergeant Charles L. Moody, a 32-year-old Air Force man, was parked near Holloman Air Force Base in the desert, watching for a predicted meteor shower, at about 1:20 a.m., when suddenly, like a flash, an object appeared, dropping from the sky about 300 feet away. It stopped about 25 feet above the desert floor and wobbled for a while, then glided toward Moody. As it came closer, Moody could see that it was a disc-shaped craft which glowed a dull, metallic gray. It was 40 to 50 feet across and 18 to 25 feet high, with three globes showing on its underside. The terrified Moody leapt back into his car and tried to escape, but his month-old battery was completely dead. Then the craft halted again, about 50 feet away, and Moody began to hear a high-pitched voice, and to see shadowy figures through a window which had appeared in the craft. Quoting the inquiry report, "Suddenly an odd glow enveloped my car, and I felt numb all over." Immediately after the experience, this numb feeling was the last thing Moody remembered before coming to, sitting in the car, and watching the craft leave, shooting straight up. But in time, the memory of the hour and 20 minutes he'd lost came back to him. Two beings had come from the craft, gliding rather than walking. They started to open the car door and Moody panicked, striking out at one of the aliens. Then, the lights went out. When he regained consciousness, he was on a table, and an alien was studying him. Moody was unable to move. The alien, which was hairless, large-skulled, with no eyebrows and round, large, 24, chapter 1, a very strange phenomenon, eyes, small nose, mouth, and ears, and thin lips, spoke, but with no lip movement. He asked if Moody was well, and told him he would release him from the paralysis if he promised not to strike out. Moody agreed, so the frail, 5-foot-tall being in the skin-tight white suit, with whitish-gray skin, touched Moody with a metal rod about 7 inches long and half an inch thick. Instantly, Moody could move freely. Moody asked if he could see the craft's propulsion system, and the alien agreed, so they left the circular room in which the examining table was in, and went through an arched doorway and then into another room, which, Moody reported, seemed almost as large by itself as the whole craft had looked from the outside. It was as though the interior of the ship were larger than the outside. In this room, there were three other beings, one apparently a woman, floating about a quarter inch above the floor. The leader told Moody to stand on a certain part of flooring, and as he did so it dropped, like an elevator, to a room below. Protruding up from the floor of this room were the top sides of the three globes he'd seen on the underside of the craft. The globes contained large crystals, on each side of which were rods which sloped in toward the crystal. The aliens gave him other information too, says Moody. They said that this ship was a small observation craft from a much larger main craft which stayed 5,000 to 6,000 miles out in space. They also told Moody that they would be making themselves known to mankind within 3 years, though they plan only limited contact at first. These aliens belong to a league of races, which our human race may one day be invited to join, if they decide to accept us. But whatever happens, the aliens will never hurt us. After this conversation, Moody was told to report to a medical facility, and he lost consciousness again, to wake up in his car. He watched the craft leave, then easily started his car and went home. Both his wife and his superior officer are convinced that the very conservative Sergeant Moody is telling the truth. Case number 15, date, the 11th of May 1975. Place, Apache Sitgreaves National Forest, Arizona investigators, Coral and Jim Lorenzen, directors of APRO, Dr. James Harder, D. of Rees, APRO. Travis Walton and six other men had been working in the forest all day, thinning wood with chainsaws. They were riding back to town at about 6:25, Chapter 1, a very strange phenomenon o'clock when they saw a yellowish glow ahead of them and to the right. The truck was on a right-hand curve, and it bumped along until suddenly it came to a clearing, where they had a very clear view of the object causing the glow. It was about 15 feet in diameter and 8 feet high, and was hovering about 15 feet above the ground, about 90 feet from their truck. They were able to estimate the size of the craft because it was hovering over a pile of slash and was about its size. The craft was glowing with a color like a Coleman lantern being lit. When Travis saw the object, he asked the driver to stop, then, without waiting for the truck to completely halt, he jumped out and walked quickly over to the pile of slash. The object gave off a beeping noise and began to oscillate around its vertical axis. There were other rumbling noises. Then a bright, narrow ray of greenish-blue light shot out from the craft and struck Walton. A bright, soundless flash surrounded Walton's body and lifted him a foot into the air and backwards, with his head knocked back and his arms outflung. One of the other men saw Walton fall to the ground after this, but all were busy running from the scene. They stopped about a quarter of a mile away, just as a light lifted up through the trees in the direction from which they had just come and streaked away. They decided to go back and find Walton. They were back at the landing site in 15 minutes, but could find no trace of the craft or of Walton. They finally gave up searching and went to the sheriff's office to report the incident and the missing Walton. The sheriff noted later that these men were extremely upset, one even weeping. Later polygraph tests bore out that they were telling the truth about their experience. In the next days, a thorough search, involving about 50 men, was made for Walton. After 2 days, the search was called off, and a missing persons report filed. On November 11, Travis Walton called his sister from a telephone booth in a nearby town. His voice was extremely weak. Her husband and her brother went to find Walton, and discovered him slumped on the floor of the booth from which he had called. He was 12 miles from the spot at which he had last been seen. He had a strange story to relate, and little by little the details were told. When he regained consciousness after being hit by the ray, he was lying on a table in a low-ceilinged room. There was apparatus resting on his lower chest. He had pains in his head and to a lesser extent all over his body. Around him stood three entities, about 5 feet tall, with large eyes, small noses, mouths, and ears, and no hair. They wore, 26, Chapter 1, a very strange phenomenon brown coveralls. Travis was panicked by the sight of these human fetuses and knocked the apparatus off his chest, striking out at the entities. The creatures calmly left the room, turning right out the doorway. Travis followed them, turning left. He went down the hall and into another room, which featured a transparent wall through which he could see what he thought were stars. He sat in a chair which had push buttons on its arm, and pushed one of the buttons. But the stars then started to move, so he left the buttons alone. A man in a blue outfit and transparent helmet came into the room and beckoned that Walton follow him. He did not answer his questions, but merely led him out of the craft, through an airlock, and down a ramp. He was now in a large enclosure in which several disc-shaped objects were parked. The air was fresher than before, the light brighter. His guide took him into another craft where he met three more humans, two men and a woman, who wore blue clothing but no helmets. They all closely resembled one another. At this point a mask, resembling an oxygen mask, was put over Walton's face, and he lost consciousness. When he regained his senses, he was lying on his back on a road. He felt the heat of a disc-shaped object which was rising into the sky above him, the doors on its bottom just closing. Walton recognized the road, walked unsteadily to the nearest phone, and called his sister. 6 days had elapsed. Tests performed immediately after Walton's return show some dehydration but no malnutrition and no possibility of drug use. The last time is blocked by a strong memory block, and APRO's careful report stated that it might be months before further information about the last time can be extracted from Walton's subconscious. This concludes our small sampling of contact cases. These few interesting cases make up only a tiny percentage of the well-documented contact cases, which now number over 2,000. This total increases almost daily.